discuss a little later on. This is Norman Guerin in the Apollo Newsroom in Washington with correspondent Ed Hickey reporting from Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. We will continue to broadcast the events as they occur regarding the mission of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington. This is the Voice of America. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Mystery still surrounds the flight of Luna 15, the latest Soviet space probe. Sir Bernard Lovell, director of the Jodrell Bank Observatory, says the station is still in contact with the Soviet vehicle, but has no information regarding its intended mission. The Luna 15 is now in a low orbit around the moon, moving at times within 16 kilometers of its surface. Dr. Lovell suggested that the unmanned Soviet space vehicle may be trying to photograph the Americans on the moon. An estimated 500 million people around the world have followed the Apollo 11 moon landing and moonwalk via radio and television. Most radio and television stations interrupted their regular broadcasts with the news of the successful landing and lunar exploration by American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin. Moscow radio did not interrupt its regular broadcasts. The lunar landing was reported on a Soviet radio station 12 minutes after it occurred, and according to a dispatch from Peking by the Yugoslav News Agency, no word of the Apollo 11 mission has been mentioned in communist China. Pope Paul praised the space trio as conquerors of the moon. At Britain's Jodrell Bank Observatory, Sir Bernard Lovell said, "One of the moments of greatest drama in the history of man." British Prime Minister Harold Wilson called the moon landing a most historic scientific achievement in the history of man. The Republic of Korea declared a national holiday. President Park Chung-hee said the people of Korea join the other people of the earth in rejoicing at the greatest feat in human history. Egyptian and Israeli fighter planes attacked each other's ground positions across the Suez Canal yesterday for the first time since the 1967 war. Egypt said it knocked down 19 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing two planes and said it shot down five Egyptian aircraft. The battle was touched off by an Israeli commando raid earlier across the canal on an Egyptian fortress. Israel said it held the fort for an hour, but Egypt said it repulsed the Israelis. Casualty reports conflict. Both sides see the fighting as a serious escalation. Reuters news agency quotes Israeli officials in Tel Aviv as saying the ceasefire between Israel and Egypt has become fiction. Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Iban met in Jerusalem yesterday with United States Ambassador to Israel, Walworth Barber. An Israeli official said Mr. Iban gave the ambassador his government's reaction to the recent Middle East talks in Moscow between Soviet officials and American Assistant Secretary of State Joseph Sisko. Israel has opposed the talks. The Council of the Organization of American States met in informal secret sessions early today in Washington. It meets again later today to consider reports from an OAS commission that is trying to enforce a ceasefire between El Salvador and Honduras. El Salvador has insisted that its troops will not leave Honduras until there are satisfactory guarantees for its people in Honduras. El Salvador also has accused Honduras of violating the OAS ceasefire that began Friday night. Honduras has denied the charge. American air attacks continue against Viet Cong staging areas north of Tai Ninh. The province, which always has been considered a sanctuary of the North Vietnamese forces, is north of Saigon along the Cambodian border. Allied ground forces moved into a bombed sector Sunday with a 4,000-man armored brigade to survey the damage done to the communist camps by American air attacks. Elsewhere in Vietnam, the lull in fighting continues. 15,000 persons in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, attended the funeral of civil rights leader Samuel de Veny. Mr. de Veny, a Roman Catholic campaigner, died Thursday following a heart attack. The 64-year-old Irish leader suffered an earlier heart attack last May after police arrested him in his home. The United States Senate will resume debate Tuesday on the controversial anti-ballistic missile proposal. The final week of debate will begin with the Senate still divided on the Nixon administration proposal to deploy the defensive system designed to protect missile bases located in the United States. Democratic Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, the leader of the opposition forces, maintains that the vote will be extremely close, with the outcome in doubt until the final vote. Supporters of the system, called Safeguard, say it is necessary to protect America's missile force in the 1970s. And the space agency says moon astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin have not been subject to any significant amount of radiation. Mission Control in Houston says Dr. Charles Berry checked out the instruments that record radiation and says they show no change, meaning the astronauts were not subject to radiation, or, at the most, a very negligible amount. That's the news from the Voice of America. This is Kay Gallant reporting.
Would you like to have a color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts? We would be happy to send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is Norman Guerin in the Apollo Newsroom in Washington with NASA Systems Engineer John Hammersmith and correspondent Ed Hickey in Houston. Ed, would you join us and give us a status report?
At the present time, the astronauts on the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, are enjoying a seven-hour rest after an eventful, historic day on the lunar surface. Michael Collins in the mothership Columbia, circling above 100 kilometers above the lunar surface, also is asleep at this time. All three men, two on the moon, one above the moon, will sleep for some 7 hours. Before retiring for the night, however, Mission Control asked astronaut Armstrong if he had deposited the messages from many state leaders around the world onto the moon, plus the flags of all the 50 states and the United Nations organization, and Armstrong replied that he had done so. An American flag is also on the moon. I think the world listened and watched while he raised the American flag. They're sleeping right now, and when they wake up in the morning, Armstrong and Aldrin will go through about a two-hour checklist of the lunar landing craft, that fragile-looking spider-shaped vehicle. Someone here has referred to that, as John Hammersmith was talking earlier, it's certainly very un-aerodynamic, nothing streamlined about it like we usually think of space missiles. But someone has called it, he looks like a glorified train wreck. Just about after and also before the astronauts retired for this evening, they depressurized the lunar landing craft and tossed out some of the equipment they no longer needed. We watched that happen. We could very readily see here the dropping over the life support system that they wore while they were walking on the lunar surface. That's the backpack. I think people have referred to it as the PLIS, the personal life support system, which carried their oxygen and so forth. And it was strapped onto their back. They have no further need for that, and they dumped them overboard along with the boots that they wore on the lunar surface to prevent contamination, if there is such. And they also some film packs. And these are the things that may repressurize the lunar module now and are sound asleep. I would imagine, John, if you could provide us with a word picture, the sleeping would be rather difficult aboard the lunar module, wouldn't it?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Ed. There are no seats in the lunar module because One, there wasn't there. It appeared to be a tough job to get them in the volume that was available. Also, there was a consideration that they could see better out the window if they were in a standing position. However, there is not a great deal of floor room, and at best, their sleeping postures are not going to be what we would call comfortable. I would imagine, though, that by the time they finally did get to sleep, they were good and tired, and the exact position and a high degree of comfort were not important factors in their going to sleep.
Well, John and Norman, I don't know about you, but I think I would have a very difficult time sleeping at all if I were them. And the first time on another planet, and no, regardless of the strenuous day that they've had and the excitement that they've had, you know that the system does wear down and sleep is necessary, but I still think I'd have a very difficult time sleeping.
Well, Ed, I'm not there, but very shortly I expect to go home and try to get a little bit of sleep and come back in to the VOA for the ascent of the lunar module, but I really doubt that I'm going to be able to drop off to sleep.
I agree with you, John.
Ed, you mentioned something a little bit ago about which I don't recall having talked about at all, and that was these goodwill messages and the dropping of them on the lunar surface. And I think that it's kind of interesting the way these messages are being left there, and they're not being left there like a train of litter or sheets of paper scattered all over the lunar surface. They are messages from leaders of 73 countries, plus statements by Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. And they all have been put onto a disk of silicon about the size of an American 50-cent piece. And they've been put on there by a microfilming technique which leaves the messages readable under a microscope, but which actually confines all these nearly 80 messages onto a very, very small surface.
Well, John, we were looking over while you were talking there over the messages that they have left and what the astronauts have said themselves. Truly, this is not just an American accomplishment, it's for the world. And I believe the people of the world feel that they're all a part of this, and this is as it should be.
That's right, Ed. We considered this a voyage or an exploratory mission in the interests of all mankind, and just not just in the interests of the United States.
When the astronauts wake up in the morning, John, they will wake up from the last report that I had from Mission Control, roughly about 9:42 Central Time. That would be 14 hours, 42 Greenwich Mean Time. And lunar liftoff, the ascent stage fires into action, and they lift off up to the mothership circling at this time. That will come at approximately 19 hours, 17 hours 51 Greenwich Mean Time, and docking will come some 4.5 hours later. That's the way I have the flight plan looking right now from the latest report from Mission Control here. At the present time, as I said, the astronauts are asleep. They were slightly behind schedule from what astronaut Deke Slayton told us here. Just before the astronauts retired, they were a little behind the timeline, but they feel that this is not important, that they can catch up with their work in the morning. About an hour and a half behind time before they retired for the night, but most of the work they feel they can pick up tomorrow when they awaken.
Yes, it's probably going to come out of their sleeping time, Ed, not out of their working time. That's how they'll make it up.
John, one thing in looking at this flight, and everything that has happened on this momentous day, and talking to people, as you have, I'm sure, and our other colleagues up there, and colleagues around the world, and our other correspondents, perhaps that this may be dangerous to try to categorize anything like this, but in talking to young people and how they feel about this, people 18, 19, in their teens or younger, You certainly couldn't call it blasé, but they take it a little bit more for granted. And it seems the older you get, when you get up to our age, and if I may add a personal note to the, this was my birthday, and I guess I'll have to remember another year if nothing else. But the older you get, it seems that it's more important. It has more meaning and significance. I presume that this is so, I don't know, or that the young people have grown up with rocketry and the space age, so to speak.
Yes, over a period of 10 or 12 years, you know, persons who are in their 20s have lived most of their lives and most of their thinking lives, when they're capable of abstract concepts, have been lived through this space age, as we're now coming to call it. So, yes, they do tend to take it for granted, just as you'll pardon me, as you took horses and buggies for granted in your boyhood.
Well, that is quite so, at least from the people I have talked to, and the young people said, you know, they said, well, this is, you know, they have known rocketry since they were born. And I can remember standing out at Cape Kennedy myself, watching John Glenn and then Alan Shepard, two other great pioneers. And you have to look at them. John Glenn was commenting earlier today during an interview with VOA's Al Johnson that at that point they didn't even know what the effect of weightlessness would have on the eyeballs, much less the rest of the body. And this is something that had to be learned just by people like John Glenn and Alan Shepard going up, just as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin or all other pioneers finding out what does the moon do to the body? What is it like? And I think this is the great heroism of these people.
At one time, Ed, I was very much interested in the medical aspects of these flights and took an intensive two-week course in space medicine, among other things, and I hadn't realized up until hearing that interview with John Glenn the great subtlety of these medical investigations.
Subtlety, how is that? they go through a great deal. We were discussing earlier when we were talking about the young people today who sort of look at the space age a little more for granted than older people who take it a little more seriously, I guess. And I was asking a group of children not too long ago, and talking to a group, a rather sizable one, asking them as far as sheer bravery was concerned and heroism, whether they believed Magellan or Columbus or Marco Polo or one of the other great explorers of a not different age was more daring than these two men today. And I think this probably reflects most of the answers, I might add, that they looked at. Columbus probably was more daring because he didn't know. He knew he was going across, but he didn't know exactly what he would find, and there were storms, and he had nothing to go with. And you can look at it in the other viewpoint, and I'd be anxious to hear your own personal views, John, of that. Here, true, the space agency has gathered a great deal from John Glenn and Alan Shepard, the doctors, the engineers, and the scientists, and they have a pretty good idea of what they might find. And this seems to detract a little bit from the young people that maybe they haven't done as much. I don't quite take it that way myself. I'm just paraphrasing what they say.
Well, Ed, we do have the previous exploration with our unmanned spacecraft, the Rangers, the Surveyors, which landed on the moon, and the Lunar Orbiters, which really gave us a pretty good idea of what the lunar environment was going to be. At least it gave us enough information that we could pretty confidently design the spacecraft and pretty confidently design the proper aids for the astronauts. Now you contrast this with the idea of Columbus. Yes, he sailed off into the unknown, and if you were to believe the commonly accepted opinions of his day, which I really bordered on folklore at the time, that he would sail out and he would go so far and he would fall off the edge and all this sort of thing. These are the kinds of stories we hear, and I think this is the kind of picture we tend to compare this with. But as a matter of fact, the thinking men of the day, and Columbus in particular, was a very astute person, and he did not go into this voyage on a daredevil basis. He had ample proof, which we would find acceptable even today, that the Earth, as a matter of fact, was round. And he had no reason to expect anything out there but the usual things that you would find on Earth, namely water and land, and perhaps some storms at sea and things like that. But he really didn't expect to find a new land. He expected to find a new route to the east. But really, in my own mind, I think he, in his own mind, felt that he had nothing to fear except the usual hazards of voyages on the high seas of his time.
Well, John, you were mentioning just a moment ago, yes, the scientists of today know a great deal more from surveyors and the lunar orbiter. Earlier, during the right after touchdown on the moon, I believe the... Have you heard whether how far they are from survey? They are very close to the surveyor landing spot, aren't they?
I haven't heard anything through the agency or through our
12 nautical miles.
12 nautical miles. That is, to the extent that we know the actual position of the spacecraft, and I'm not sure that we know I think we know much more accurately the position of the surveyor at this time than we do the position of the lunar module.
That doesn't seem to disturb the fact that they don't know the pinpoint location of Eagle on the lunar surface. Doesn't disturb the mission control here at all. The only comment I heard from them is that, well, we know it's on the moon. And I think the world knows it also from watching television around throughout all the world and listening to radio broadcasts. And
even if we should not locate it very, very, very precisely, by the time they take off a little later today, the amount of uncertainty of its exact location is such that we don't have to worry about navigational problems.
One comment was made here at Mission Control. John, perhaps you could explain a little. He said, when that question was asked of what is the exact location of Eagle on the lunar surface, and the comment, as I mentioned, that they weren't quite sure yet, but they would certainly know probably before they lift off, but it really wouldn't affect the ascent at all except perhaps use a little extra fuel. Now, why would this be so?
Well, Ed, if you know the route you're going to take very precisely to get from one place to another, it takes less fuel than if you don't know your way so well, and I think that's exactly what was being expressed here. Since they don't know exactly where they'll be taking off from, that introduces a small amount of uncertainty into the exact flight path that they will have to fly to carry out a rendezvous. Therefore, it may take a little more fuel than would be the case if they had landed exactly where we thought we wanted them to land.
While we're discussing this subject of ascent or takeoff from the moon later today, John, I'd like to ask, I've heard conflicting reports, not necessarily conflicting, but two that the answers that I've heard around here at Mission Control didn't quite exactly whichever point of view you want to listen to. What had happened if the lunar module, on taking off, the engine cut out early, or... there was something went wrong. How far down to the lunar surface could the mothership Columbia go?
Well, I heard this question asked Mike Collins by a newsman before the mission, and he didn't want to put it in terms of actual numbers. I think what was in the back of his mind was that he would come just as close as he dared in order to effect a rescue. But I think that an order of magnitude number might be somewhere on the order of 10 to 15 kilometers would probably be the minimum altitude he would dare come down to. And he would have to come down to that in a manner, in a trajectory that would keep him in orbit. And by the same token, for him to do any good, the lunar module would have to be in orbit about the moon. It wouldn't be enough for it to just get up off the surface.
We just had a late report, John, from Mission Control here on the status of astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin, and Mission Control reported that they were resting, perhaps dozing off and nodding, but not asleep, which just about bears out what you said earlier. I would imagine sleeping in the cramped quarters there is a little difficult. The heart rates They were trying to get some heart rates of the astronauts and Collins in Columbia. In the Columbia mothership, circling 100 kilometers above the lunar surface, is reported to be sound asleep, and at the present time is in the 21st revolution of the moon. Getting back to our ascent engine, John, how reliable is that? That is the one system, I believe, if I'm wrong, correct me, but isn't that the one system of the whole lunar module that is not duplicated? I mean, that only has one engine and only has one part, isn't that right?
There is a little, just a little bit more to it than that, Ed. It is not the only system that is not duplicated. It's the only system in the lunar module for which there is no backup. In the case of the descent engine, if it had gone out at some point, it was always possible then to light the ascent engine and at least enable the men to get back to the command and service module. But in the case of the ascent engine, it must work at least for a period of time long enough to get them into some kind of an orbit about the moon.
Well, in describing the descent to the lunar surface, I believe our audience was made aware of the fact that the descent engine, you could control it like you would an automobile. You could make it more power on, less power, and fly it just like an airplane. You can't do this with the ascent engine, the one that's used for taking off, can you?
No, that's right. The term we use, and I think what you were saying is embodied in a single word, is expressed by a single word, throttleable. And the ascent engine is either on or off. Some people drive that way, too, Ed, either stop and go, stop or go.
Ed Hickey in Houston, you and John were talking about the Great Adventure, and Britain's Arthur C. Clarke, a science fiction writer and a science fact writer as well, was asked by a national magazine to weigh the consequences of man's first extraterrestrial venture. Some quotable quotes, I think. "The moon is only the first milestone on the road to the stars. The exploration of space by man and machine, for each complements the other, will be a continuing process with countless goals, but no final end." Then he says, "The frontier, which only a generation ago seemed lost forever, is open again, and this time it will never close." And Ed, do you have anything else to report down there?
I'll give you the final last report that we have had to bring our audience up to date, Norman. Just a few moments ago, the mission control reported that Neil Armstrong is not yet asleep. Astronaut Aldrin is not asleep either. Both are dozing off. They're having a little difficulty in sleeping, but they are resting at the moment. And Michael Collins in the mothership, circling above the lunar surface, is sound asleep.
Well, thank you so much, Ed Hickey. We'll be back with you later in the program. And at this particular time, I would like to remind our listeners in the Far East, if they're listening to 17775 and 15180, switch to frequencies 15190, 11850, 9735. In Southeast Asia, switch from 15270 to 15110. And 15155. Europe, those listening to 5995, 9635, 7200, 9740, switch to 9760, 17855, and 15205. Some listening reminders on frequency switches. And John Hammersmith, I think perhaps it's about time that you're going to be joining Mr. Collins in a bit of sleep.
In the land of Nod, that's right.
And we welcome Merle Waugh, who was with us earlier in the day, Director, Program Control, Advanced Manned Mission Programs Office, NASA. Welcome back, Merle.
Hi, Norm.
And we have a lot to talk about in the next few hours, too. Thank you so much, John.
Yes, good night, or should I say good morning?
Good morning at this state. And you're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. The Eagle now on the lunar surface for some 13 hours and 13 minutes. This program is originating in Washington. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of Late World News.
The day man landed and walked on the moon has drawn to an end. The two American astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, said goodnight to ground control during the past hour and settled down to sleep in their landing craft on the surface of the moon. Just over 6 hours ago, astronaut Armstrong slowly climbed down the ladder from the lunar lander and became the first person from the planet Earth ever to set foot on another terrestrial body. As he stepped from the bottom rung onto the surface of the moon, he said, "That is one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." A few minutes later, astronaut Aldrin followed him down the ladder, and for more than 2 hours, the astronauts explored the lunar surface. Now they are safely back in their spacecraft, and in 8 1/2 hours, they will leave the moon to rejoin astronaut Michael Collins in the Apollo 11 command ship for the long trip home. In other news around the world, the Council of the Organization of American States met early today in Washington and plans another session later today to consider reports from a commission that is attempting to enforce a ceasefire between quarreling Central American neighbors Honduras and El Salvador. An Egyptian official has termed Sunday's fighting along the Suez Canal between Egyptian and Israeli forces as a very serious escalation of their conflict. American air attacks continue against Viet Cong areas near the Cambodian border, while there still is a lull in ground combat. U.S. General Earl Wheeler, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told newsmen in Saigon that the current decline in fighting is cyclical and may be followed by new communist offensives. Italian Premier-designate Mariano Rumor continues his search for a coalition cabinet to replace his center-left government that collapsed 2 weeks ago. U.S. Senator Edward Kennedy is reported resting under a doctor's care at his family's summer home after a car he was driving crashed into a deep pond, killing a woman passenger. And air traffic controllers in the United States are reportedly preparing enough resignations to cause massive delays at the nation's airports. That's the news from the Voice of America. Kay Gallant reporting.
You're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. At last report from Mission Control, astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin in Eagle on the lunar surface. On the lunar surface now, some 13 hours and 16 minutes are dozing, while command pilot Collins is sound asleep in orbit around the moon. Here's the way it happened. When we here on Earth saw the first television pictures taken on the moon, and man, in the person of astronaut Neil Armstrong, took his first step on the lunar surface, VOA reporter Rhett Turner described it for us.
TV circuit breaker's in.
Buzz saying he's got the TV circuit breaker
in.
Turning on the camera.
Roger.
Here we go. Now we can see a
picture
from
the
moon.
TV.
Picture of the TV.
You got a good picture, huh? There's a great deal of contrast in it, and currently it's upside down on our monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
You're the first live pictures from the surface of the moon. We can see some movement there.
Okay, would you verify the position opening I ought to have on the camera?
It's upside down. They've had to turn it around. They've had to reverse the picture. Neil has stepped down. He's now down on the foot pad. Armstrong's foot is on the foot pad.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
It's very dark. We
okay,
can see.
I just checked, getting back up to that first step. It's not even collapsed too far. But it's adequate to get back up. Roger, we copy.
Pretty good little jump.
He wants to check how hard it is to get back up to that first step. It's quite a reach. He has a foot down on the foot pad. We can't tell if he's stepped off onto the surface
yet. This is Houston, F2, 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
It's a silhouetted picture. It's very
at
difficult
the foot of the
to
ladder,
see.
The lamb foot beds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Down there is very fine.
Armstrong is standing on the foot pad. We can see him moving around now. He is undoubtedly...
I'm going to step off the lamb now.
He's stepping off. He has put his left foot off on the surface of the moon. Man is
That's
on the moon.
One small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
One small step for man, one giant leap for man. Neil Armstrong's first words on the surface of the moon.
That was VOA's Rhett Turner. Geologists have long wondered about the material covering the surface of the moon. Here's how it was described by astronaut Neil Armstrong as he set about performing his first lunar duty, gathering a contingency sample of the lunar surface. Again, VOA's Rhett Turner described the event as witnessed on television. The first voice we hear is that of Neil Armstrong.
Yes, the surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and inside of my boot. I only go in a small fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine sandy particles.
Neil, this is Houston. We're copying.
Armstrong said that the surface of the moon was fine and powdery. He is holding on with one hand at all times. To the now he's just turned loose. He's walking around now.
There seems to be no difficulty in moving around as we suspected. It's even perhaps easier than the simulations of 1/6G that we performed in various simulations on the ground. Absolutely no trouble to walk around.
We can easily see him moving around right near the foot pad and the ladder. He's staying just within a few meters.
This engine did not leave a crater of any size. It has about 1 foot clearance on the ground. We're essentially on a very level place here. I can see some evidence of rays emanating from the descent engine, but... very insignificant amount. It's quite dark here in the shadow and a little hard for me to see that I have good footing. I'll work my way over into the sunlight here without looking directly into the sun.
Neil has stepped off. He's gotten his footing on the surface, measured what it's like to walk around on the surface. They're now extending the sample collection bag. It's been lowered on this pulley device, a cord. We cannot see Neil very clearly at this moment because he's in lunar shadow and the camera is pointing at him, and only reflection from the surface is bouncing off of his suit into this television camera. He's getting the contingency sample now.
That's good.
But he is out of range of the camera. Buzz Aldrin is reporting that is good. He is
okay,
now
the
at
contingency
least.
Sample is down and it's up sample.
Aldrin is reporting, I believe, there.
gets a little difficult to dig through the crust.
Very interesting. It's a very soft surface, but here and there where I plug with the contingency sample collector, I run into very hard surface, but it appears to be very cohesive material of the same sort. I'll try to get a rock in here.
A powdery surface that appears to...
a couple.
But when he scoops down just a bit below the surface, he runs into something very hard. Back here on the in the television picture,
that looks
which
beautiful
is...
from here, Neil.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Shortly after both astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had set foot on the moon, a voice at Mission Control in Houston informed them that they had a telephone call. It sounded like this.
Neil and Buzz, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you. Over.
That would be an honor.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you... For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. And for people all over the world, I am sure they too join with America in recognizing what an immense feat this is. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world. And as you talk to us from the Sea of Tranquility, it inspires us to redouble our efforts to bring peace and tranquility to Earth. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this Earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here representing not only the United States, but and of peace of all nations. And with interest and a curiosity and with a vision for the future. Honor for us to be able to participate here today.
And thank you very much, and I look forward, all of us look forward to seeing you on the Hornet on Thursday.
Look forward to that very much, sir.
By far the longest long-distance telephone call. President Nixon talking from the White House with the American astronauts on the lunar surface. This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. Now, here is a listening reminder for the quarter hour. Listeners in the Middle East, tune to 21650, switch to 15270, and 17855. Lunar Module Eagle has been on the surface of the moon some 13 hours and 27 minutes. Mrs. Janet Armstrong, wife of astronaut Neil Armstrong, describes her feelings at the moment of touchdown on the moon to a group of waiting reporters.
How did it feel at the moment of touchdown?
Oh, I was terribly excited. It's a marvelous thing that we have successfully managed to land safely on the moon.
What was the reaction of the children, the two boys?
We were very excited.
Is Neil carrying anything for you to the moon?
Yes, but that's private.
You're not going to tell us? Animal or vegetable or mineral? Was there any special incantation today, any special prayer, something that you can share with us that you had as those moments near touchdown came?
No, we have said our prayers all along. From the time they had separation, we knew it was... go all the way, and I didn't say any extra special prayers at that time. My faith is with me always.
Are you going to encourage the two boys to become astronauts?
No, I will encourage the boys to do whatever they would like to do.
What do you think they'd like to do?
That's completely up to them.
Can you tell us what you'll be doing tonight and from now on?
I will be continuing to follow the flight and listening to their descriptions on the moon. I'll be reading them in the mission reports again and over and over and over again. I think it's fantastic, and I'm just about as excited as you all are.
And in Houston, the wife of Michael Collins, who remained in the command module in orbit around the moon, and who at this moment is asleep, according to Mission Control, talked with newsmen following the lunar landing.
I thought it was positively marvelous. The men there sounded a lot calmer than I was.
Were you really nervous?
No, I wasn't nervous. I was excited. I thought it was wonderful the way they described the way they were coming in and what they were doing. I was very excited, as a matter of fact.
How would you evaluate what they've done so far?
Well, from what I know about it and how I've tried to follow it, it seemed to me that it's all just going along like clockwork. I think it's marvelous so far.
Have you kind of calmed down a little bit now that they at least have landed?
What do you mean? I've been calm.
Is the worst of this over as far as you're concerned?
There hasn't really been a worst. If you mean, can we all settle down a little bit and just watch and wait for the rest of the time? I don't ever do that during a flight. You have to take each step as it comes, but I think it's going beautifully.
How about your children? Do they know what's going on? Do they have an appreciation of what's happened up there?
They sure knew what was going on today.
What was their reaction?
Oh, they thought it was great. Just great. They were telling us, you know, they're down, it's fine.
Your husband, along with astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin, is going to become a world-renowned figure when he gets back. How do you think it's going to be being the wife of a world figure?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't let my mind go to that far at all as yet.
Do you think he's disappointed up there that he didn't get down to the moon?
Don't you think he's probably with them in spirit? He doesn't sound a bit disappointed to me.
Do you think he'll want to go there, though, someday himself?
Well, I think he'd like to go, but I know how happy he has been from the beginning to be part of this team, to be on this crew. He's been happy about that, and I'm happy for him.
And in the biggest city of the United States, the biggest crowds collected in the city's biggest park, Robert L. Redeen reports.
The biggest crowd in New York Sunday night was gathered in the sheep meadow of Central Park. An estimated 50 to 60,000 persons, most of them under 30, watched one of three huge television screens set up by the three large United States television networks. All three, by no coincidence, offered their version of man's landing on the moon. The crowd cheered when Neil Armstrong's foot touched the moon's surface, Buzz Aldrin got a similar ovation, and so did the placement of the flag of the United States on the moon. An unsuccessful attempt at the park to send a man aloft in a hot air balloon provided a momentary distraction. Many in the park left after the two astronauts had safely landed. As one man told his wife, "We'll watch the rest of it at home." Several salesmen were offering pennants for sale with the words "Men on the Moon," and another was peddling early souvenir editions of the Daily News. A girl interviewed by one of the TV networks drew a cheer when she said, "The moon landing will bring the American people closer together." Rain clouds over New York obscured a view of the moon and for an hour or so drizzled on the crowd. But the television pictures here were excellent, and so were the spirits of the people who viewed history in the making from the moon. This is Robert L. Redeen, Voice of America, in New York's Central Park.
And this is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. Norman Guerin in the Apollo newsroom in Washington. Reports from Ed Hickey, correspondent in Houston, Mission Control Center. And with me, Merle Wall, our NASA expert in residence for the next few hours with us. Merle, you were with us earlier in the day for the lunar landing, and you're back with us now for a while. What were your overall impressions of the EVA activity?
Well, Norma, it was, of course, very exciting for everybody. I was with my family, trying to sit in front of television and keep them awake until they could so they could actually participate and see it. But it kept taking longer and longer, and finally they just fell asleep, and my wife and I watched it by ourselves. My overall impression is that it came out very much like I expected.
What was the greatest element of surprise, as far as you're concerned, a NASA engineer that's worked with the program very closely? Would you say the landing and the terrain, perhaps?
No, I would say I expected them to be much more cautious when they stepped out on the lunar surface, and I guess I was quite surprised when Aldrin started hopping around and...
They adapted very quickly.
Trying his kangaroo jump and things like that. And I think I expected them to be more conservative since they had so much riding on their performance. But I was very pleased to see that it came out that way because in the first place it looked very much like Neil Armstrong says, a California high desert. And the only thing, there didn't appear to be any rattlesnakes or cactus around.
And it seems that they were quite surprised, as we mentioned a little earlier, that there was a certain amount of color to the specimens that they saw and perhaps collected.
I suspect that's geologically speaking. If you've ever been out on the amongst the rocks and you're trying to find something of value, you read a lot of color into things. I imagine it's all quite bland, but hidden within the rocks is probably some very unusual formations.
And apparently the dust problem was evident for a short while, about 30 feet above the surface of the moon, but did not pose any great problem. It did make some of the lunar rocks slippery, as I recall from one of the reports from Buzz Aldrin.
I'm not sure that was the reason that it... I heard him say that, too, that the rock, that it was slippery. But I gather that was the phenomena of having some sort of a hard base with a lighter powdery material over the top, sort of like when you have a fresh powder snow, you tend to get very slippery.
I should think that you would be very pleased as an engineer with the systems operation to this point in the mission.
Well, without a doubt, it's everything's going very well. I guess that you might say that our conservatism has paid off, but it looks like we are quite conservative about everything we've planned. You always have to work hard to be sure you've taken care of every contingency, and it looks like we have so far.
We were talking about that, the design, this functional vehicle called Eagle that's sitting on the lunar surface facing southwest, I believe, at this particular moment. And there again, it's very versatile. For example, I was thinking to myself as a layman that the descent stage brought them down. It serves as a launching pad for that very critical maneuver tomorrow. But once it put them on the surface of the moon, it served as a sort of workbench, did it not?
Oh, yeah. It provided compartments for all the equipment and supplies they needed while they were there at a fairly convenient height above the ground. I guess the only disadvantage was that you had to have a ladder to descend to the surface because you had to be erected vertically, and of course the lower stage was designed rather squatly so that you didn't have too much of a climb up or down. But as it turns out, again, it seems to be very straightforward to climb up and down that ladder.
Didn't appear to be rather too difficult. Easy. Yes, I should say so. Well, tell us something about that very critical maneuver tomorrow. This will come about 17 hours 55 GMT when it's time to fire the ascent stage. Now, what do they have to do just generally to program the systems and get ready for this? We'll get into this in detail as the program progresses.
Well, of course, the main thing they have to do is to put in information into their computer that relates where they are to the orbit that Mike Collins is in. And according to what I've heard this morning, now that I'm up, they have not been able to locate the LEM any more precisely than they had last night. Now, I imagine their efforts are continuing to try to pinpoint his exact location, or the exact location of the Eagle, so that this information can be fed precisely into the guidance computers for the ascent back into lunar orbit. Without any further detailed information to locate it, they can feed in nominal information based on their estimates of where they landed. And then after ascent, when they get into the phases where the radar is working, they can then update and guide in accurately to the command module.
You're speaking of radar in this ascent maneuver, which will take place tomorrow and which will be carried in our continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Now, that would be the rendezvous radar?
Right.
And they can update their position in regard to this.
They can update, and they can manually override, and they could even... there's even a procedure they can follow with everything. If everything failed, they could still do some sort of a rendezvous maneuver within limits.
They can use this rendezvous radar just to update, just as they did using the landing radar to update the pings, the primary navigational system, on this very important 12-minute descent. Is that right?
That's right.
Is there anything else that struck you regarding the EVA activity? It seemed to me at one time that the contingency pickup was perhaps out of sequence from what we had expected. The first moment he stepped off the ladder, seemed that he proceeded to take pictures, as I recall.
That again was a
an option.
That again was what was a surprise to me in the latitude that he had when he got there, or that he took anyway. It's possible that was an option that was up to him. Well, certainly it was up to him because he was in charge up there, but that again surprised me with regard to its lack of conservatism, of not following the procedure pretty precisely. But it didn't seem to be that critical, and I guess he got just about everything done he was supposed to get done during the time they were on the surface.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of reaction to the EVA and the general flight of Apollo 11. In Rangoon, Burma, is reportedly a sleepy city today because many of its residents were awake all night listening to the Voice of America's account of the moon landing. We join them. The American Embassy received dozens of telephone calls congratulating the astronauts, while hundreds of other Burmese are listening to VOA reports on public address speakers at the American Embassy, according to reports. Now, here's a listening reminder for the hour. Listeners in Southeast Asia, now tuned to 15210, switch to 15155. Listeners in Europe, listening to 379 meters medium wave, tune to 15270. And 11960. You're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Lunar Module Eagle and its two astronauts are on the surface of the moon at Tranquility Base, the code name for the call between Mission Control and the lunar surface. They've been on the lunar surface some 13 hours and 42 minutes. Stay with us for all of the events concerning the flight of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington.